This is Audible.
Warriors Don't Cry, a searing memoir of the battle to integrate Little Rock Central High, by Melba Patillo Beals. Narrated by Lisa Renee Pitts. Copyright 1994 by Melba Patillo Beals. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Melba Patillo Beals, care of Sandra Dijkstra Agency, LLC, and was produced in the year 2011 by Tantor Media Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Time Brings About a Change, updating Warriors Don't Cry in 2007. Grandmother always said that time brings about change, and as time moves forward, our significant life events become a series of snapshots in our minds. Today, at age 65, I realize she was so right. I am alive and well, and my head is filled with life event photos, some events that I thought would be my undoing. These days, I have little fear of what is to come because I realize it is all ultimately part of a wonderful mystery unraveling with each day. But when I first heard Grandmother's wisdom, I was 15 years old, frightened, and caught up in the middle of a political firestorm over racial segregation. Eight other teenagers and I stood at the center of the tug of war between the U.S. government, Arkansas's governor, and the angry white mobs intent on halting integration in Little Rock's Central High School. At the time, I had no idea of the impact or importance of our successful entry and very difficult year as students inside Central High. It would turn out that our determination to remain in school, despite having to tread through a jungle of hatred and human torture from segregationists, would help to change the course of history and grant access to equality and opportunity for people of color. My younger brother, Conrad Patillo, would become the first black U.S. Marshal in Arkansas's history. In the years to follow, a black woman would become Little Rock's mayor. Many African Americans would serve in the same legislature that 50 years ago voted to halt integration. And yes, Central High's population would diversify and even flourish under a black principal. On August 20th, 2005, hundreds of people, many of them white Arkansans, gathered on the grounds of the Arkansas State Capitol for the unveiling of statues of the nine of us. On this day, many of the people who once scorned us have come to congratulate us for standing our ground, for claiming our equality, for completing that year at Central High School against all odds. This was a place where it is said that the Ku Klux Klan had gathered in their white robes back in 1957 to plan our demise. But today, the area is filled with admirers, whites, blacks, Asians, human beings of every description. There are also more than 100 news reporters and flashing media cameras with dignitaries, U.S. senators, state legislators, and ministers. And with the city's uniformed police officers, yes, members of the same Little Rock force once dispatched to keep us out of Central High in 1957, who were there this day to protect us, to ensure passage through the crowds and safe entry onto the stage. My attention was riveted to the black cloth draped over my statue, which appeared to be even taller than my 5'8", though considerably slimmer than my now senior body. I couldn't help wondering, what does the statue really look like? Does it truly resemble me at age 15? Pull the cord now. One of the program coordinators whispered. Suddenly, my hand reached out, and I pulled. The audience applauded wildly, then fell into a weird, whispering silence. I stood frozen, my eyes and my person riveted on the statue. I thought, My God, it's me. Me, with a ponytail, a young face, a tall, thin body clutching my books to my chest. It is me, poised, ready to attend a day at Central High. I felt as though I must hug this innocent, wide-eyed young girl. I must shelter her wounded spirit. Suddenly, the throng of reporters was pushing forward, moving closer, only a few feet away, determined to get pictures of me and the eight others as we stared at our young images. We nine were oblivious as we examined our younger selves. We were overwhelmed with tears, immersed in the moment, emotionally weeping at the sight of the nine statues, so real, so commanding. When we nine are together, we become one, falling into lockstep, anxious, happy to be together once more. Now we were crying together, grateful we had made it to this moment, alive and celebrating on a spot where we might have been hanged. This year, 2007, marks the 50th anniversary of the integration of Central High. To celebrate that occasion, a coin will be available from the U.S. Mint, a Little Rock Museum will be opened, and former President Clinton will host a celebration. It will be a week of galas and joyous cavorting. Huge committees of Little Rock's finest have convened over the past 2 years with the sole purpose of creating the right events at the right times to attract people and publicity from around the world. Going forward, I am grateful for this time of celebration, but I don't want it to obstruct all our perceptions of the fact that there is a lot of work still to be done. We have only survived and triumphed in round one of the bouts that have made and continue to remake America. There are so many more steps to be taken to achieve human equality. The first round of this battle was never about integration, in my opinion. It was always about access. Access to opportunity, to resources, to freedom. The enemy was more visible, the battle lines drawn in plain sight. What I call the new racism is about success. Success in terms of cultural, social, and economic status. I have achieved so much, more than 100 awards for courage, including this country's highest award as voted by the U.S. Congress, the Congressional Gold Medal, doctoral degrees and status as a professor and international speaker, and bling in many circumstances. And yet, when I go house hunting, I am often denied the chosen location because to the person selling the house, I am just another maid, Aunt Jemima, or second-class citizen, as always. Until I am welcomed everywhere as an equal, simply because I am human, I remain a warrior on a battlefield that I must not leave. I continue to be a warrior who does not cry, but who instead takes action. If one person is denied equality, we are all denied equality. Melba Patillo Beals. Author's note from the 1994 edition. Some people call me a heroine because I was one of nine black teenagers who integrated Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas in 1957. At the age of 15, I faced angry mobs, violent enough to compel President Eisenhower to send combat-ready 101st Airborne soldiers to quell the violence. I endured a year of school days filled with events unlike any others in the history of this country. Although this happened over 35 years ago, I remember being inside Central High School as though it were yesterday. Memories leap out in a heartbeat, summoned by the sound of a helicopter, the wrath in a shouting voice, or the expression on a scowling face. From the beginning, I kept a diary, and my mother, Dr. Lois Patillo, a high school English teacher, kept copious notes and clipped a sea of newspaper articles. I began the first draft of this book when I was 18, but in the ensuing years, I could not face the ghosts that its pages called up. During intervals of renewed strength and commitment, I would find myself compelled to return to the manuscript, only to have the pain of reliving my past undo my good intentions. Now, enough time has elapsed to allow healing to take place, enabling me to tell my story without bitterness. In some instances, I have changed people's names to protect their identities, but all the incidents recounted here are based on the diary I kept, on news clippings, and on the recollections of my family and myself. While some of the conversations have been recreated, the story is accurate and conveys my truth of what it was like to live in the midst of a civil rights firestorm. Introduction. Little Rock Warriors 30 Years Later. The Little Rock Nine come together for the first time since 57. Headline, Arkansas Gazette, Friday, October 23, 1987. The stone steps are slippery with morning drizzle as we begin the tedious climb up to the front door of Central High School. It is the first time in 30 years that we nine black alumni have entered this school together. In 1957, as teenagers trying to reach the front door, we were trapped between a rampaging mob threatening to kill us to keep us out, and armed soldiers of the Arkansas National Guard dispatched by the governor to block our entry. On this day, Arkansas Governor Billy Clinton, who in less than 6 years will be President of the United States, greets us warmly with a welcoming smile as he extends his hand. We are honored guests, celebrating both our reunion and 30 years of progress in Little Rock's race relations. Cameras flash, reporters shout questions, dignitaries lavish enthusiastic praise on us, and fans ask for our autographs. And yet all this pomp and circumstance, and the presence of my 8 colleagues, does not numb the pain I feel at entering Central High School, a building I remember only as a hellish torture chamber. I pause to look up at this massive school, 2 blocks square and 7 stories high, a place that was meant to nourish us and prepare us for adulthood. But because we dared to challenge the Southern tradition of segregation, this school became, instead, a furnace that consumed our youth and forged us into reluctant warriors. On this occasion, we nine ascend the stairs amid a group of reporters and dignitaries gathered here for the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People convention. I have a slight tension headache, and like some of the others, I am yawning. Even though each one of us is 40-something, we were up very late last night enjoying one another's company and giggling just as we did when we were teenagers. Long past the hour that should have been bedtime, we gathered in Ernie's suite to catch up on the years when we were separated from each other. Our senior member, and now a Shearson Lehman Hutton vice president, Ernie treated us to all the room service we could handle. Still, the fun we enjoyed last night does not make it easier to appear nonchalant on this occasion. Some of us take another's arm to brace ourselves as we prepare to face the ghosts in this building. Even as we speak of how much we dread touring this school, some of us blink back tears to smile for the media, shake hands, and sign autographs. "How does it feel to be in Little Rock again?" a reporter shouts. "Weird," I reply. We nine have come from our homes around the world. Gloria, a magazine publisher, is a citizen of the Netherlands. Minnie Jean, a Canadian citizen, is a writer and raises her 6 children on a farm. Shearson VP Ernie comes from New York. Thelma has come from her Illinois teaching duties, and Dr. Terry Roberts comes from his UCLA professor's post. Carlotta is a Denver realtor, and Jeff is a Defense Department accountant from California. Only Elizabeth stayed on in Little Rock, where she is a social worker. It is significant that almost all of us chose not to remain in Little Rock, but sought lives elsewhere. All of us bring children. Some are adults now, like my daughter, Kelly. Others are toddlers, or the same age as we were when we attended Central. We have observed each other's graying hair and balding spots and noted paunches brought on by the years. Time has, nonetheless, been kind to us. Our relationships with one another and the joy of our camaraderie have not changed. For me, our reunion has been a rediscovery of a part of myself that was lost, a part that I long to be in touch with. I have missed these eight people who, by virtue of fate's hand, are most dear to me. Since our arrival in Little Rock, we have laughed and cried together and talked nonstop. We have both relished and dreaded this moment when we would again walk up these stairs. Today, if I let the memories flood in and listen closely, on these same stone steps I can hear the click-clack of leather boots, boots worn by soldiers of the 101st Airborne dispatched to escort us past the raging mob. I hear the raspy voices of their leaders commanding, "Forward march!" as we first walk through these front doors on September 25th, 1957. "What was it like to attend Central?" asked one reporter. "I got up every morning, polished my saddle shoes, and went off to war," I reply. "It was like being a soldier on a battlefield." "It was a teenager's worst nightmare," someone else shouts. "What's worse than to be rejected by all your classmates and teachers?" "What's it like to be back here again?" another reporter asks. "Frightening," one voice says. "Most of us have rarely come back to Arkansas as adults. Even though my mother and brother continue to live here, I have only found the strength to visit 5 times in 30 years because of the uneasy feeling the city gives me. 3 of those visits have been since Bill and Hillary Clinton took over the governor's mansion, because they set a tone that made me feel safer here."
"How does the city look to you now?"
I answer the question to myself. Very different from when I lived here. Today, I could not find my way around its newly built freeways, its thriving industrial complexes, its racially mixed, upscale suburban sprawl. It is a town that now boasts a black woman mayor. My brother, Conrad, is the first and only black captain of the Arkansas State Troopers, the same troopers that held me at bay as a teenager when I tried to enter Central. We reach the crest of the first bank of stairs, turn right at the landing, and begin mounting the next set of steps when we hear more shouting from the reporters.
"Stop! Look this way, please! Can you wave?"
I am annoyed. You'd think I'd be more patient with their questions, since I am a former NBC television news reporter and have been a working journalist for 20 years. But it's different when you're the person being barraged by questions. I resent their relentless observation of the 9 of us during such a personal time. Still, I try to smile graciously because these reporters have traveled a great distance from their posts around the world to be here. Where is Governor Faubus? I wonder. Where is the man who dispatched armed soldiers to keep 9 children out of school, who bet his life and his career that he could halt integration? Faubus is quoted on the newswires today, saying if he had it to do over again, he'd do the same thing. What do you think about that? A reporter asks. If we had it to do again, we'd do the same, Terry quips.
Why isn't Farbus here?
Someone asks. Because he wasn't invited, a reporter replies. At least that's what he says. He retired to some small town in Arkansas. As we near the top of the second bank of stairs, I sense that something is missing. I look below and see that the fountain has disappeared. It once stood directly in front of the 100-foot-wide neo-Gothic entryway, with stairs ascending to it on both sides. Hearing my expression of surprise, a man I do not know explains, "Someone threw jello into it, so they concreted it over." I pause, as I recall what a treacherous place that fountain was in 1957, when students repeatedly tried to push us the 60 feet or so down into the water. Nobody thought to close it then. All at once, I realize the questions have suddenly stopped. I am surrounded by an anxious silence, like the hush of an audience as the curtain is about to rise. The main entrance of the school is now clearly in sight. I feel a familiar twinge. A cold fist clamps about my stomach and twists it into a wrenching knot. And just at that instant, it is October of 1957, and I am a helpless, frightened 15-year-old, terrified of what awaits me behind those doors. What will they do to me today? Will I make it to my homeroom? Who will be the first to slap me, to kick me in the shin, or call me nigger? Suddenly, one of the huge front doors swings open. A black teenager, impeccably dressed in morning coat and bow tie, emerges. He is slight, perhaps 5 feet 6 inches tall, with closely cropped hair, wearing wire-rimmed spectacles. He bows slightly as we approach. Good morning. I am Derek Noble, president of the student body. Welcome to Central High School. 1. In 1957, while most teenage girls were listening to Buddy Holly's Peggy Sue, watching Elvis gyrate, and collecting crinoline slips, I was escaping the hanging rope of a lynch mob, dodging lighted sticks of dynamite, and washing away burning acid sprayed into my eyes. During my junior year in high school, I lived at the center of a violent civil rights conflict. In 1954, the Supreme Court had decreed an end to segregated schools. Arkansas Governor Orville Faubus and states' rights segregationists defied that ruling. President Eisenhower was compelled to confront Faubus, to use U.S. soldiers to force him to obey the law of the land. It was a historic confrontation that generated worldwide attention. At the center of the controversy were 9 black children who wanted only to have the opportunity for a better education. On our first day at Central High, Governor Faubus dispatched gun-toting Arkansas National Guard soldiers to prevent us from entering. Mother and I got separated from the others. The two of us narrowly escaped a rope-carrying lynch mob of men and women shouting that they'd kill us rather than see me go to school with their children. 3 weeks later, having won a federal court order, we black children maneuvered our way past an angry mob to enter the side door of Central High. But by 11 that morning, hundreds of people outside were running wild, crashing through police barriers to get us out of school. Some of the police sent to control the mob threw down their badges and joined the rampage. But a few other brave members of the Little Rock Police Force saved our lives by spiriting us past the mob to safety. To uphold the law and protect our lives, President Eisenhower sent soldiers of the 101st Airborne Division, the elite Screaming Eagles, Korean war heroes. On my third trip to Central High, I rode with the 101st in an Army station wagon guarded by jeeps with turret guns mounted on their hoods and helicopters roaring overhead. With the protection of our 101st bodyguards, we black students walked through the front door of the school and completed a full day of classes. But I quickly learned from those who oppose integration that the soldiers' presence meant a declaration of war. Segregationists mounted a brutal campaign against us, both inside and out of school. My 8 friends and I paid for the integration of Central High with our innocence. During those years when we desperately needed approval from our peers, we were victims of the most harsh rejection imaginable. The physical and psychological punishment we endured profoundly affected all our lives. It transformed us into warriors who dared not cry even when we suffered intolerable pain. I became an instant adult, forced to take stock of what I believed and what I was willing to sacrifice to back up my beliefs. The experience endowed me with an indestructible faith in God. I am proud to report that the Little Rock experience also gave us courage, strength, and hope. We 9 grew up to become productive citizens with special insights about how important it is to respect the value of every human life. I am often asked, in view of the state of race relations today, if our effort was in vain. Would I integrate Central if I had it to do over again? My answer is yes, unequivocally, yes. I take pride in the fact that, although the fight for equality must continue, our 1957 effort catapulted the civil rights movement forward, a giant step, and shifted the fight to a more dignified battlefield. For the first time in history, a president took a very bold step to defend civil rights, our civil rights. Back then, I naively believed that if we could end segregation in the schools, all barriers of inequality would fall. If you had asked me in 1957 what I expected, I would have told you that by this time, our struggle for human rights would have been won. Not so. But I am consoled by the words my grandmother spoke. Even when the battle is long and the path is steep, a true warrior does not give up. If each one of us does not step forward to claim our rights, we are doomed to an eternal wait in hopes those who would usurp them will become benevolent. The Bible says, watch, fight, and pray. Although I am perplexed by the state of race relations in this country today, I am at the same time very hopeful because I have ample evidence that what grandmother promised me is true. With time and love, God solves all our problems. When we returned to Central High School for our first reunion in 1987, many Little Rock residents, white and black, greeted the 9 of us as heroines and heroes. Hometown white folk in the mall smiled and said hello and offered directions even when they did not recognize us from our newspaper photos. During all the fancy ceremonies, some of Arkansas's highest officials and businessmen came from far and wide to welcome us. And perhaps the most astounding evidence that things have indeed changed for the better was the attitude of Governor Bill Clinton. "Call me Bill," he said, extending his hand, looking me in the eye. "You all come on up to the house and sit a while." He flashed that charming grin of his. A few minutes of conversation assured me that his warm invitation was genuine. He is, after all, a man my brother refers to as good people, based on their working relationship over the years. So my 8 friends and I found ourselves hanging out at the governor's mansion, the one Faubus built. Governor Clinton sauntered about serving soft drinks and peanuts. He and his wife, Hillary, were the kind of host and hostess who could make me feel at home, even in the place where Farbus had hatched his devilish strategies to get the nine of us out of Central High School by any means possible. You all ought to think about coming on back home now. Things are different, Governor Clinton said. He had been 11 years old when Farbus waged his segregationist battle against us. He displayed genuine respect for our contribution to the civil rights struggle. That visit was to become an evening I shall always treasure. As Chelsea played the piano and Bill and Hillary talked to me as though we'd known each other always, I found myself thinking, "Oh, Mr. Farbus, if only you and your friends could see us now." My grandmother, India, always said God had pointed a finger at our family, asking for just a bit more discipline, more praying, and more hard work because he had blessed us with good health and good brains. My mother was one of the first few blacks to integrate the University of Arkansas, graduating in 1954. 3 years later, when Grandma discovered I would be one of the first blacks to attend Central High School, she said the nightmare that had surrounded my birth was proof positive that destiny had assigned me a special task. First off, I was born on Pearl Harbor Day, December 7th, 1941. Mother says while she was giving birth to me, there was a big uproar with the announcement that the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor. She remembers how astonished she was, and yet her focus was necessarily on the task at hand. There was trouble with my delivery because Mom was tiny and I was 9 pounds. The doctor used forceps to deliver me and injured my scalp. A few days later, I fell ill with a massive infection. Mother took me to the White Hospital, which reluctantly treated the families of black men who worked on the railroad. A doctor operated to save my life by inserting a drainage system beneath my scalp. 24 hours later, I wasn't getting better. Whenever Mother sought help, neither nurses nor doctors would take her seriously enough to examine me. Instead, they said, "Just give it time." 2 days after my operation, my temperature soared to 106, and I started convulsing. Mother sent for the minister to give me the last rites, and relatives were gathering to say farewell. That evening, while Grandmother sat in my hospital room, rocking me back and forth as she hummed her favorite hymn, "On the Battlefield for My Lord," Mother paced the floor, weeping aloud in her despair. A black janitor, who was sweeping the hallway, asked why she was crying. She explained that I was dying because the infection in my head had grown worse. The man extended his sympathy. As he turned to walk away, dragging his broom behind him, he mumbled that he guessed the Epsom salts hadn't worked after all. Mother ran after him, asking what he meant. He explained that, a couple of days before, he had been cleaning the operating room as they finished up with my surgery. He had heard the doctor tell the white nurse to irrigate my head with Epsom salts and warm water every 2 or 3 hours, or I wouldn't make it. Mother shouted the words, "Epsom salts and water!" as she raced down the hall, desperately searching for a nurse. The woman was indignant, saying yes. Come to think of it, the doctor had said something about Epsom salts. "But we don't coddle niggers," she growled. Mother didn't talk back to the nurse. She knew Daddy's job was at stake. Instead, she sent for Epsom salts and began the treatment right away. Within 2 days, I was remarkably better. The minister went home and the sisters from the church abandoned their death watch, declaring they had witnessed a miracle. So, 15 years later, when I was selected to integrate Central High, Grandmother said, "Now you see, that's the reason God spared your life. You're supposed to carry this banner for our people." 2. Black folks aren't born expecting segregation, prepared from day one to follow its confining rules. Nobody presents you with a handbook when you're teething and says, "Here's how you must behave as a second-class citizen." Instead, the humiliating expectations and traditions of segregation creep over you, slowly stealing a teaspoonful of your self-esteem each day. By the time I was 3 years old, I was already so afraid of white people that when my red-haired, white-skinned cousin, Brenda, came to babysit, I hid beneath mother's bed. Like many non-white Southern families, ours included people with a variety of skin tones and physical features. Although Daddy's skin was brown like mine, some of his relatives looked white. My mother was fair-skinned as well, but Brenda's skin color was made more stark by her flaming red hair. As a toddler, growing up in Little Rock, Arkansas in 1945, I felt safe only in my sepia-toned world, a cocoon of familiar people and places. I knew there were white people living somewhere far away, and we didn't do things together. My folks never explained that I should be frightened of those white people. My fear developed as I observed adults and listened to their conversations. With alarmed expressions, they often whispered, "The white folks won't like us to do that," or, "We don't want to anger the white folks." Whenever we walked uptown among white people, Mother held my hand too tight. I could see the fear in her eyes, feel the stiffening of her body as white people walked past. If we happened to be in their path, she quickly shoved me aside, according them the privilege of first passage. If white adults were accompanied by children, those kids scowled or stuck their tongues out at us. Even worse, they'd sometimes say, "Mama, look at that there nigger." Those trips to town became my primer on relating to white people. While shopping in the Five and Dime one hot summer day, I urged my mother to ask the waitress behind the lunch counter to give me a glass of water. She clutched my arm and whispered that we had to use our own drinking fountain. I started to cry aloud. I looked over to see the shiny chrome fountain the white people used. I didn't want to go to our fountain marked colored. It was the old dusty one located in an isolated part of the store where I was afraid to go even with Mother. Mother says when she tried to usher me to our drinking fountain, I caused such a fuss that the store manager chided her and asked if we were some of those uppity niggers from the north come to stir up trouble. By the time I was 4 years old, I was asking questions neither my mother nor grandmother cared to answer. "Why do the white people write colored on all the ugly drinking fountains, the dingy restrooms, and the back of the buses? When will we get our turn to be in charge?" Grandma India would only say, "In God's time. Be patient, child, and tell God all about it." I remember sitting on the dining room floor, writing letters to God in my Indian head tablet. I painstakingly formed the alphabet just as Grandma had taught me to do in order to distract me from my asthma cough. I could do the multiplication table through 10 and read and write simple sentences by the age of 4 as a result of all those long nights working with her. I also wrote to God about getting a park where I could swim and ride the merry-go-round. Whenever we went to Fair Park, the grown-ups warned me not to walk near the pool. We had to stay in a separate area. If I asked about riding the merry-go-round, Mother Lois and Grandmother India got very nervous. They would tell me there was no space for me as they dragged me away. When the mailman failed to bring a reply from God and things at the park didn't change, even after a year, my patience wore thin. With each passing day, I realized just how different things really were for me. When I was 5, I had my first true bout with testing the harsh realities of segregation. My family. Grandmother, mother, daddy, and Conrad, plus most of my aunts and uncles, had gathered at Fair Park for a 4th of July picnic. As usual, we were separated from the white people, set apart in a wooded section away from the pool and the merry-go-round. While the grown-ups busied themselves setting up the meal, I made my escape, sneaking away to ride the merry-go-round. I had had my eye on one horse in particular, Prancer, the one I had dreamed about during all those months as I saved up the 5 pennies I needed to ride him. I reached up to give the concessionaire my money.
"There's no space for you here," the man said.
But I pointed to Prancer's empty saddle. That's when he shouted at me and banged hard on the counter, spilling my coins on the ground.
"You don't belong here, pickaninny."
I didn't know what that word meant, but his growling voice hurt my ears and made my knees shake. Angry faces glared at me as though I'd done something terribly wrong. Scurrying past the people waiting in line, I was so terrified that I didn't even take the time to pick up my precious pennies. At 5, I learned that there was to be no space for me on that merry-go-round, no matter how many saddles stood empty. As a young child, my life was centered around the big old white wood frame house at 1121 Cross Street. That was my home. I lived there with my mother, Lois, her mother, my grandmother, India, my father, Howell, and my brother, Conrad. 7 red cement stairs led up to the front door. A giant rubber plant stood just inside the front hallway next to tall mahogany bookcases that held the cherished volumes of Shakespeare, Chaucer, and Emily Dickinson, and of James Weldon Johnson and Langston Hughes that Grandma and Mother loved so much. Some of the shelves held the textbooks Mother used for teaching 7th grade English and for the night classes she took to get her master's degree. Next came the living room with its tattered, overstuffed green velvet chair and matching couch. The half-moon-shaped radio with brass knobs sat on a round mahogany table. Wine-colored leather chairs stood on either side. Great-grandma Ripley's clock and a copper horse that had belonged to great-grandpa rested on the mantel over the fireplace. The kitchen had a huge old-fashioned stove, a red chrome-trimmed breakfast table and chairs, bright yellow walls, and a linoleum floor with visible marks of wear and tear. Grandma could usually be found scrubbing it sparkling clean, or baking cornbread, simmering collard greens, or preparing her special gourmet salmon souffle. She had learned to cook some of her fancy dishes when she worked as a maid in white ladies' kitchens on Park Hill. Much of that time, she earned only $1 a day, which she used to support her 3 children after Grandpa died. Since they had very little money, my uncle and aunt worked to help Grandma put my mother through college. My favorite place in our house was Grandma India's bedroom, filled with her dibbies, the name she gave the personal things that a body treasures and holds close to the heart. Her room always smelled of fresh flowers. Antique velvet scarves with satin fringe draped the back of her rocking chair and the back of the overstuffed maroon velvet chair in the corner by the window. There were photographs of her travels to an Indian reservation where her husband, Grandpa Charles Payton, had grown up with his people in Canada. There were also old tin plate photos of her travels as a young woman to Italy with her father, great-grandpa Ripley, when he accompanied his boss to Rome on business. I couldn't decide which of her treasures I loved most, her 8-foot-tall antique armoire with its ornate oriental carvings, her iridescent green music box that played Stardust, or the special Dutch girl quilts she created with colorful fabric profiles
in each square.
I don't remember life without Grandmother India. Mother and Daddy had lived with her in North Little Rock even before I was born. When they purchased our Little Rock house, Grandma came with them. Unlike Mother, who was delicate and fair, Grandma was tall and copper-skinned. She had pronounced cheekbones and huge, deep-set, almond-shaped eyes that peered at me from behind wire-rimmed spectacles. She had a regal posture and a fearless attitude. My happiest evenings were spent listening to her read aloud from the Bible, from Archie comic books, or from Shakespeare. I sometimes gave up my favorite radio programs like the Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy show, our Miss Brooks and the Aldrich family, to hear her read to me. For as long as I can remember, I spent late afternoons with Grandma India in her garden, tending her 4 o'clock plants. I would stand beside her, holding onto her skirt, as she pulled the weeds or held the water hose. That's when we had our private talks. Once when I was 6 or so, I explained to her that I believed each human being was really only a spirit, made by God, and that our bodies were like clothes hanging in the closet. I said I thought that one day I would be able to exchange my body for a white body, and then I could be in charge. Some of your thinking is right, child. We are not these bodies. We are spirits, God's ideas. But you must strive to be the best of what God made you. You don't want to be white. What you really want is to be free. And freedom is a state of mind.
Yes, ma'am, but
I hope you haven't told anyone else about spirits and bodies.
She squeezed my hand.
Well, have you?
No, ma'am.
Good. It's time you started keeping a diary so you can write down these thoughts and share them with me sometimes. But mostly, keep them to yourself and tell God.
The next time she went to town, she brought me a pink diary that I could lock with a little key. Most evenings before sleeping, I looked forward to going to my bedroom to write to God. I was actually giving God an exam because he hadn't kept his promise so far. I had asked Grandma could I still trust him, and she had said,
"Always, child. But remember, it's his schedule, not yours. His good will come when you least expect it."
My room was a place for my stuffed animals to live and a home for my huge brown Raggedy Ann doll, the one Grandma India made for me. It was a magical place where I daydreamed for hours as I listened to music or radio shows. There, I could be whoever I wanted. I could be white. I could be free. My brother Conrad's bedroom was filled with strange trucks, glass jars of crawly bugs, and a wooden train Daddy made for him. Conrad spent lots of time counting marbles, putting puzzles together, and playing Monopoly. His room always seemed to be cluttered with pieces and parts of things, and Daddy would often march into Conrad's room and demand that he put all his toys and trucks back into the red wooden box they had built together. Daddy worked for the Missouri Pacific Railroad as a hostler's helper. He would arrive home, his huge muscular body obviously tired from the physical labor of his job. Mother constantly reminded him that if he'd finish just one more course, he could graduate from college and have a professional job that paid more. But he resisted, saying he preferred to work outside in the fresh air where he was free. He loved hunting and fishing and getting away to the wilds where nobody could bother him. It made Mother very angry that he wouldn't follow her advice. I worried they might do what my friend Carolyn's parents did, get a divorce. At the time, I didn't know the meaning of that word, but I knew that when it happened, her daddy was gone forever.
The dining room, with its big oval table, was the place we gathered each night for dinner and evening games. Daddy sat in the brown leather chair, reading his newspaper and working his crossword puzzles. Grandma entertained us with reading or checkers and chess so we wouldn't bother Mother as she studied for her night school exams. She was determined to complete her master's degree. When she began graduate school, our people couldn't attend classes with whites at the University of Arkansas. After much grumbling and dickering, white folks had begun to allow small departments to integrate class by class. She would tell us the story of the lone black man who was trying to integrate the law school. In the classroom, he was forced to sit confined by a white picket fence erected around his desk and chair. When he needed to come or go, he sometimes stumbled over that fence. White people around him sometimes stumbled over that fence, too. And still, each day when he arrived, there it was, encircling him, keeping him separate but equal. Mother began meeting with a few others from our community who were also determined to be admitted to the Graduate School of Education at the university. At the time, they were attending extension classes, but in a separate space set aside for our people. Sometimes we got telephone calls from people warning us not to push any further to integrate the university. Nevertheless, Mother Lois continued her meetings and her classes. I will always remember the night she casually looked up from her papers to tell us she would be one of the first of our people to attend the University of Arkansas. There was a nervous quiver in her voice. The glance she exchanged with Grandma made me realize they were both frightened of what lay ahead. "I can't turn back now," Mother said. "Forward is the only way our people can march." Later that winter, she smiled as she talked across the dinner table about the integrated classes. Some nights she would come home exhausted, her face pale and drawn, her teary eyes reflecting the discomfort of her plight. When I asked what happened, she would only say white folks were stubborn about seeing our people as God's ideas. Nevertheless, she survived. A few years later, in 1954, she tugged me forward by my hand as Conrad and Grandma walked just behind us up the sidewalk to her graduation. It was a rare occasion, for I saw a few white folks look at Mother with a pleasant expression. This time she didn't seem as nervous around them, maybe because she was wearing the same black cap and gown they were as she held the diploma in her hand. "It's the first graduate degree I know of in this family," Grandma India said, stroking the document as though it were the same precious tablet given Moses in the Bible. Within our community, we were considered middle-class folk. The middle-class label was mostly because of Mother's teaching job. It didn't mean we had lots of money or lived without struggling to pay our mortgage or the bills. Preachers, teachers, and doctors were usually the only professionals in our community, and hence they were accorded a special kind of respect because they had educational degrees. Certainly, we were not considered radical integrationists or people who made waves. We were quiet, church-going folks. Daddy's uncle, Benjamin Patillo, was a preacher who traveled from city to city conducting revivals. I remember spending many a night sitting and fanning myself in churches as he preached, while aunts and cousins joined in the choir. We lived in the heart of my community, a short distance from the church and school I attended. As I grew older, I began going places on my own, like to ballet or piano lessons and to Girl Scout meetings. Still, my immediate neighborhood and its people continued to be the most important threads of the tapestry that was my life. With the passage of time, I became increasingly aware of how all of the adults around me behaved the same. They were living with constant fear and apprehension. It felt as though we always had a white foot pressed against the back of our necks. I was feeling more and more vulnerable as I watched them continually struggle to solve the mystery of what white folks expected of them. They behaved as though it were an awful sin to overlook even one of those unspoken rules and step out of their place, to cross some invisible line. And yet lots of discussions in my household were about how to cross that line, when to cross that line, and who could cross that invisible line without getting hurt. On the rare occasions when a white person came into our house, children and adults alike would all stand at attention, staring, waiting for them to give orders. There was the milkman, blonde and smiling, who leered at Mother Lois every time he delivered our milk. Usually, he would insist that she bring him a drink of water, even when she pleaded she didn't have the time. He'd set down his metal case with its glass bottles of undelivered milk and wink at her as he gulped his water. She would clasp her shaking hands, nervously waiting for him to finish and go away. Finally, he would hand the bottle of milk to her, but when she tried to take it from him, he wouldn't let go and kept holding it tight, forcing her to plead for it. And that's when he would offer her free milk and ice cream if she cooperated with him. Mother Lois's face would turn red, and her mouth would tighten just the same way it did when the insurance man offered her free premiums if she'd be his special colored lady. As always, when either of these men behaved inappropriately, she would urge me to go inside. But somehow I knew I had to disobey. I had to stay with her. Even though they were all adults, the milkman seemed to have some strange power over her, just as the insurance man and other white people did. I watched as she struggled to stay calm while the milkman hassled her. Sometimes my father stood silent in the next room, peeking through a crack in the door and listening to those men insult Mother. He would clench his fist and clear his throat loud, but he wouldn't show his face or say anything. Afterward, he would either storm out, mumbling under his breath, or sit down in the chair at the dining room table and bury his face in his hands. Sometimes he talked loud as though he were really going to do something awful, but only after the white men left our house. I could tell he really loved Mother and wanted to protect her, but there was an awful big fear keeping him silent. I would sit beside him as he took his shotgun out, oiled and cleaned it. There was a sad, pained look in his eyes as he would turn to me and say, "You understand, don't you? That man's got no call to talk to your mama that way." He stood, then paced as he wrung his hands and whispered, "God, give me strength and patience to do your will." He would stroke my cheek and smile as he continued to answer as though he could hear all the questions in my head. "Someday things will be different. Someday our men will be respected and not be called boy and treated like children." Then he would calm down and smile, describing his visits to states like North Dakota and Pennsylvania, where our men were treated as equals, where they looked white men in the eye fearlessly, where they could protect their women. These were places where we would all move someday. There were so many times when I felt shame, and all the hope drained from my soul as I watched the adults in my family kowtow to white people. Whenever we shopped at the grocery store, they behaved as though they were worried about something. The grocer, tall, skinny Mr. Whalen, with his Adam's apple sticking out above his collar, his fish-belly blue-white skin and oversized fingernails,
was the white man I saw most often, at least twice a week. I would accompany one or more of the adults in my family to his